This is the TED Radio Hour. Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for? I've never known that.
Delivered at TED conferences around the world.
It's the gift of the human imagination.
We've had to believe in impossible things.
The true nature of reality beckons from just beyond.
Those talks, those ideas, adapted for radio. From NPR. I'm Guy Raz, and our first story today comes from a man named Mark Bezos. We caught up with him.
In Scarsdale, New York.
Scarsdale. Isn't that where all the characters from Mad Men lived, and then they would commute down to Manhattan?
That is correct. That is what many of us do here in Scarsdale, yes.
You smoke cigarettes and sleep around?
I do not, but oh. I am a fan of scotch.
Oh, I see. Okay, got it.
Yes.
Which is where the comparisons with Don Draper end, because Mark...
Standing at the firehouse.
He's a firefighter.
Watching Engine 56 go by, as a matter of fact.
Actually, a volunteer firefighter. And we called him up to hear a story he told on the TED stage about his very first fire. So tell me the story.
It was in the middle of the night. It was probably 3:30 in the morning. And the pager went off. And I leapt out of bed and just started spinning around in circles because I wasn't quite sure what the noise was. My wife let me know that it was, in fact, the fire pager going off.
Okay, so the way it works in Scarsdale, which is the way it works in a lot of smaller towns, is that professional firefighters are always on duty, and they respond first. So if you're a volunteer, like Mark, you get a call or a text or a page at home. So Mark rushes to the fire scene.
So we arrive on the scene, you put on the gear.
And there are flames jumping out of the second story of the house.
It happened to be terrible weather. Rain was coming down horizontally. It was just a really bad night.
And Mark sees the homeowner. She was standing with the fire captain, barefoot in the rain, watching her house burn.
And she was pretty excited when she was talking to the captain and come to find out that her dog was in the house. She was very concerned about the dog.
So Mark rushes to the captain for his orders, but there was one other volunteer on the scene who had arrived just a few minutes before Mark.
The captain called him over and asked him to go inside and get the homeowner's dog.
And you were right behind him, and what did you think?
To be honest, I was jealous. You know, you do an awful lot of training, and you have these visions of, you know, the opportunity to go in and do something heroic, save an animal, save a dog, save somebody who's in a burning building. And so I thought this was my moment. I'm going to end up coming back home and my kids are going to look at me like I'm 10 feet tall and bulletproof.
Now maybe you can see where this is all going. This is not what happened.
Yes.
What happened instead was the captain called Mark over.
And he asked me to go into the house to get the homeowner a pair of shoes. Which was not exactly what I was hoping for.
So Mark goes inside the house, he grabs the pair of shoes, they weren't in a particularly dangerous part of the house, and he brings them back outside to the homeowner.
I just handed them to her, I said, you know, you might be more comfortable if you put these on or something like that. But you know, she was very focused on the dog at that moment, so I don't know that our eyes ever met over the handoff of the shoes.
And then Mark headed home, feeling kind of disappointed.
I went from hero to zero at that point, at least.
But a few weeks later, the fire department received a letter in the mail.
The letter was, you know, was very effusive, thanking everybody for you know, all of the effort in saving her house and her property and obviously the dog. And then she noted that someone had even taken the time to go into the building and get her a pair of shoes, which had touched her greatly.
What did you think when you read that?
It's one of those things that it's so easy to dismiss the opportunity to do something good because you're hoping to do something great. There are opportunities dozens of times a day to make a difference in somebody's life, as small as, you know, returning a smile or offering the first smile. I mean, there's just so many opportunities. That's, I think, the big lesson for me.
Here's how Mark ended his TED Talk.
So as I look around this room at
people who either have achieved or are on their way to achieving remarkable levels of success, I would offer this reminder. Don't wait. Don't wait till you make your first million to make a difference in somebody's life. If you have something to give, give it now. Serve food at a soup kitchen, clean up a neighborhood park, be a mentor. Not every day is going to offer us a chance to save somebody's life, but every day offers us an opportunity to affect one. So get in the game. Save the shoes. Thank you.
Mark Bezos, he works for Robinhood. It's an anti-poverty group in New York. And on the show today, giving it away. Stories from TED speakers who give stuff, their art, their food, their time, their ideas, and the things that happen when they do. So if you want a quick snack in South Central Los Angeles, some options might be...
some hot Cheetos or some Coke, Pepsi, or anything sugary.
This is Ron Finley. And those snack options, a problem he wanted to solve.
How do you introduce yourself? Like, how do you describe yourself to people?
You know, I call myself a renegade evolutionary.
Sounds dangerous.
It is dangerous.
I'm thinking like you're armed with two carrots.
No. A pitchfork and a hoe.
Oh, gotcha. Okay, that's a little bit more violent than a carrot.
No, I'm a renegade. I'm a gangster gardener.
Oh, I got it.
You know, I'm not that kind of gardener with overalls and, you know, the straw in his mouth.
Yeah.
It's a new world.
Okay, so Ron Finley's story, how he became a gangster gardener, starts in his neighborhood.
I live in South Central. Liquor stores, fast food, vacant lots. I live in a food desert, South Central Los Angeles, home of the drive-thru and the drive-by. Funny thing is, the drive-thrus are killing more people than the drive-by. I see wheelchairs bought and sold like used cars. I see dialysis centers popping up like Starbucks. So I figured that the problem is the solution. Food is the problem, and food is the solution. Plus, I got tired of driving 45 minutes to get an apple that wasn't impregnated with pesticides. So what I did, I planted a food forest in front of my house. Right now, I'm standing in front of the pomegranate trees. Beets, collard greens, three kinds of kale growing.
This is Ron Finley's garden.
I like different levels. I like different colors, different textures, different smells. You know what? You ever had an alpine strawberry?
No.
They're white and they're like this tangy, two kind of flavor taste. Can you see these almonds growing on my tree right here? I mean, they're beautiful.
And his garden, it's literally in front of his house, on the sidewalk, open to the public 24/7. No formal invitation required. And in the beginning, the idea of a community garden on the sidewalk in South Central was so strange that his neighbors would mock him. They'd call him...
Ronnie Appleseed.
Ronnie Appleseed.
I remember this time, there was his mother and a daughter, 10:30 at night, and they were in my yard. And I came out, and they looked so ashamed. So I'm like, man, it made me feel bad that they were there. And I told them, you don't have to do this like this. This is on the street for a reason. It made me feel ashamed to see people that was this close to me that was hungry. And this only reinforced why I do this. And people ask me, Finn, aren't you afraid people are going to steal your food? And I'm like, hell no, I ain't afraid they're going to steal it. That's why it's on the street. That's the whole idea. I want them to take it, but in the same time, I want them to take back their health.
You just gave it away.
Yeah, and that's what it's for. It's on the street for a reason. I want you to enjoy this food.
The food part seems important, but it sounds like there's something bigger that you're kind of going after, something about just sharing.
It feels good. It feels good to be able to share. It feels good to be able to change something. It feels good to give. But, I mean, within that, you also have to receive. And a lot of people... they have a problem with that. My thing is that's what the yin and the yang is all about.
So Amanda Palmer, who we're going to hear from later in the show, she says that you know, you have to ask somebody if you also want to give. Like that's an integral part of it.
I think that's the yin and the yang. It has to have balance. This garden is about bring some, get some. If you want food, bring some food or bring something. You know, just don't come take. It's mandatory that you have to give. And you have to be able to receive. Just imagine if we had one whole block, a cooperative, that they grow food and you know what your neighbor's growing, so you don't have to grow it because you know Mabel's doing the carrots and you know Tex is doing the onions and you know you have the cabbage and fruit trees. That would be my perfect world.
Ever since planting his garden, Ron Finley and a group of volunteers have worked on almost 20 other gardens. And his neighbors, even strangers, they've given him wheelbarrows, seedlings, plants, entire trees. Sometimes they just leave them on his front porch.
I see young people, and they want to work. But they're in this thing where they're caught up. I see kids of color, and they just on this track that leads them to nowhere. So with gardening, I see an opportunity where we can train these kids to take over their communities, to have a sustainable life. And when we do this, who knows? We might produce the next George Washington Carver. But if we don't change the composition of the soil, we will never do this. What I'm talking about is putting people to work and getting kids off the street and letting them know the joy, the pride, and the honor in growing your own food. So what I want to do here, we got to make this sexy. I want us all to become ecolutionary, renegades, gangster gardeners. We gotta flip the script on what a gangster is. If you ain't a gardener, you ain't gangster. Get gangster with your shovel, okay? And let that be your weapon of choice. So basically, if you wanna meet with me, don't call me if you wanna sit around in cushy chairs and have meetings where you talk about doing some shit. If you wanna meet with me, come to the garden with your shovel so we can plant some shit. Peace. Thank you.
That's Ron Finley. You can see his full TED Talk at ted.npr.org. This should be like gardening gangster rap.
Yeah. Well, there is one. There's a friend of mine, Keith Cross, has a song called Homegrown. That is the bomb.
I'm a crop farmer, I got what you need. But I ain't blowing smoke when I say I grow trees. It's funny this economy is based on greed. More people don't farm who got mouths to feed.
On the show today, giving it away. I'm Guy Raz. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Stay with us.
Spend on watering crops, I get right back because I don't shop for groceries. Man, I got that home.
It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, giving it away, which isn't how Dan Pallotta started out, because when he was a kid in Malden, Massachusetts, Dan Pallotta's focus was on making, as in making money.
It was me and Patrick Bruno. We had, you know, we were the two big competitors in the neighborhood, and he had the Leone's lawn, which was the prized lawn. You wanted to get the Leone's lawn because they paid like $6. And I had the Luke's, and they paid $5, and the Worcester's, they paid $4. But then, that winter, I bought a snowblower from my neighbor for $60. I bought a Toro snowblower, 8-horsepower snowblower, and that was the winter we had the blizzard of 78. I made the $60 back in the first 6 inches. I remember Mr. Locke telling my mother, that kid's gonna go places.
And he did. College at Harvard, elected to the school board at 19, a budding entrepreneur. But something happened on the way to Wall Street. Dan Pallotta decided he could make and give, an idea that eventually upended his life. He told the story on the TED stage.
I want to talk about social innovation and social entrepreneurship. I want to talk about how the things we've been taught to think about giving and about charity and about the nonprofit sector are actually undermining the causes we love and our profound yearning to change the world. Charitable giving has remained stuck in the US at 2% of GDP ever since we started measuring it in the 1970s. Why has poverty remained stuck at 12% of the U.S. population for 40 years? Why have our breast cancer charities not come close to finding a cure for breast cancer, or our homeless charities not come close to ending homelessness in any major city? And the answer is, these social problems are massive in scale, our organizations are tiny up against them, and we have a belief system that keeps them tiny. We have two rule books, one for the nonprofit sector and one for the rest of the economic world. So Amazon went for 6 years without returning any profit to investors, and people had patience. But if a nonprofit organization ever had a dream of building magnificent scale that required that for 6 years, no money was going to go to the needy, it was all going to be invested in building this scale, we would expect a crucifixion. We tell the for-profit sector, spend, spend, spend on advertising until the last dollar no longer produces a penny of value. But we don't like to see our donations spent on advertising and charity, as if the money invested in advertising could not bring in dramatically greater sums of money to serve the needy. And if we tell the consumer brands, you may advertise all the benefits of your product, but we tell charities, you cannot advertise all the good that you do, where do we think the consumer dollars are going to flow? So in the for-profit sector, the more value you produce, the more money you can make. But we have a visceral reaction to the idea that anyone would make very much money helping other people. Interesting that we don't have a visceral reaction to the notion that people would make a lot of money not helping other people. You know, you want to make $50 million selling violent video games to kids, go for it. We'll put you on the cover of Wired magazine. But you want to make $500,000 trying to cure kids of malaria and you're considered a parasite yourself.
And this idea, well, it's personal for Dan. Because back in the mid-1990s, he formed a for-profit company. It was called Pallotta Teamworks. And it was designed to help charities and nonprofits raise money and grow a lot.
We didn't charge a percentage like some firms do. We just charged the fixed fee for each event. You know, okay, we'll produce this event in Boston for, whatever, $250,000, no matter how much it raises. And 100% of the money went to the charities.
So Dan's first event was a charity bike ride for AIDS research. And he launched it with $50,000 in seed money he got from a gay rights group in L.A.
We netted $1,013,000 on that first event, and we had predicted that we'd net $600,000. So it was a huge success. And
wow, you turned $50,000 into more than a million.
Net, yeah. We didn't just turn it into a million, because that proved the concept, right? So on that basis, other people wanted to do the AIDS rides, and other people started putting up capital, and at the end of 9 years, that little idea was $108 million net.
The years between 1994 and 2002 were a period of incredible growth for Dan's company. For 8 solid years, he ran the organization unlike any charity or nonprofit. Instead, it operated just like a for-profit company. Because it was.
Like in those days, everything was in black and white. Printing in color was a big deal for a charity, and you rarely saw it. So one of the things was, I want color brochures. I want color ads.
So the second year he helped to mount that AIDS charity ride, the organizers wanted to expand to New York.
And I thought, we need a full-page ad in the arts and leisure section on a Sunday in the New York Times.
$40,000 to run that ad in the New York area.
That $40,000 ad brought in $2.5 million in revenue. And so, of course, you start buying more ads when you see that.
And with more money, Dan hired more people, but not from the nonprofit world.
You know, 12, I think, vice presidents, and they were all top-notch. They'd come from law firms and for-profit businesses.
And some of them made six figures. Dan also hired professionals to produce his events, to mount these giant theatrical experiences.
We had this incredible professional touring team for the logistics, top-notch carpenters and riggers and electricians and plumbers.
All the while, Pallotta Teamworks grew into a national force, 350 people in 16 offices.
Boston, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, L.A., Washington, D.C., San Diego, Miami, Dallas, Denver, Seattle. You know, you're firing on all cylinders and everyone's working really hard. To be around that kind of success, especially when it's in the name of these important causes, you know, there's nothing like it. And millions of dollars got raised at the same time.
And the company was nimble. It could turn on a dime. It didn't have to run every decision by a board the way lots of other nonprofits do. And Dan owned it. He had a personal stake in its success.
You know, I just didn't want to build something and put my heart and soul into something and maybe my money. And eventually, you know, I put up everything I was worth to borrow money to launch the AIDS vaccine rides. I signed personal guarantees. I didn't want to do that without being able to own it, without being able to have equity in it.
2002 was our most successful year ever. We netted for breast cancer alone, that year alone, $71 million after all expenses. And then we went out of business. Suddenly and traumatically. Why? Well, the short story is our sponsor split on us. They wanted to distance themselves from us because we were being crucified in the media for investing 40% of the gross in recruitment and customer service and the magic of the experience. And there is no accounting terminology to describe that kind of investment in growth and in the future other than this demonic label of overhead. So on one day, all 350 of our great employees lost their jobs because they were labeled overhead. Our sponsor went and tried the events on their own. The overhead went up. Net income for breast cancer research went down by 84% or $60 million in 1 year.
Almost all of Dan's business came from that one sponsor. And because of the media criticism, no other charities wanted to work with the group.
And, you know, we needed $12 million every year, essentially, to capitalize the events, because the events would cost a lot of money at first before the money, the donation money, would start coming in. And, you know, we just couldn't find that money overnight. And we had a payroll to meet. We had to shut the company down. There was no, it had become too big to do a small layoff.
That must have been personally devastating.
Yeah, it was. It was the saddest day of my life, you know. And I lost my partner to suicide, and you know, I've had many, many friends die. But to lose your whole professional family in one day, you know, 350 people gone. Yeah, it was a death, but worse, because you know, when someone dies, people come with flowers and they surround you with support. When your company goes out of business, everybody heads for the hills. You know, it's the entrepreneur's fate, I guess, when something goes wrong, but it's about as lonely and devastating an experience as I can think of, and I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy.
This is what happens when we confuse morality with frugality. And we think of this as our system of ethics, but what we don't realize is that this system has a powerful side effect, which is it gives a really stark, mutually exclusive choice between doing very well for yourself and your family or doing good for the world to the brightest minds coming out of our best universities, and sends tens of thousands of people who could make a huge difference in the nonprofit sector marching every year directly into the for-profit sector because they're not willing to make that kind of lifelong economic sacrifice. Business Week did a survey, looked at the compensation packages for MBAs 10 years out of business school. And the median compensation for a Stanford MBA with bonus at the age of 38 was $400,000. Meanwhile, for the same year, the average salary for the CEO of a $5 million-plus medical charity in the U.S. was $232,000, and for a hunger charity, $84,000. Now, there's no way you're going to get a lot of people with $400,000 talent to make a $316,000 sacrifice every year to become the CEO of a hunger charity. Some people say, well, that's just because those MBA types are greedy. Not necessarily. They might be smart. It's cheaper for that person to donate $100,000 every year to the hunger charity, save $50,000 on their taxes, so still be roughly $270,000 a year ahead of the game, now be called a philanthropist because they donated $100,000 to charity, probably sit on the board of the hunger charity, indeed probably supervise the poor SOB who decided to become the CEO of the hunger charity, and have a lifetime of this kind of power and influence and popular praise still ahead of them. Now, this ideology gets policed by this one very dangerous question, which is, what percentage of my donation goes to the cause versus overhead? There are a lot of problems with this question. I'm going to just focus on two. First, it makes us think that overhead is a negative, that it is somehow not part of the cause. But it absolutely is, especially if it's being used for growth. Now, this idea that overhead is somehow an enemy of the cause creates the second much larger problem, which is it forces organizations to go without the overhead things they really need to grow in the interest of keeping overhead low. So we've all been taught that charities should spend as little as possible on overhead things like fundraising under the theory that, well, the less money you spend on fundraising, the more money there is available for the cause. Well, that's true if it's a depressing world in which this pie cannot be made any bigger. We've all been taught that the bake sale with 5% overhead is morally superior to the professional fundraising enterprise with 40% overhead. But we're missing the most important piece of information, which is, what is the actual size of these pies? Who cares if the bake sale only has 5% overhead if it's tiny? What if the bake sale only netted $71 for charity because it made no investment in its scale and the professional fundraising enterprise netted $71 million because it did? Now, which pie would we prefer, and which pie do we think people who are hungry would prefer? Here's how all of this impacts the big picture. I said that charitable giving is 2% of GDP in the United States. That's about $300 billion a year. But only about 20% of that, or $60 billion, goes to health and human services causes. The rest goes to religion and higher education and hospitals. And that $60 billion is not nearly enough to tackle these problems. But if we could move charitable giving from 2% of GDP up just one step to 3% of GDP by investing in that growth, that would be an extra $150 billion a year in contributions. And if that money could go disproportionately to health and human services charities, because those were the ones we encouraged to invest in their growth, that would represent a tripling of contributions to that sector. Now we're talking scale. Now we're talking the potential for real change. But it's never going to happen by forcing these organizations to lower their horizons to the demoralizing objective of keeping their overhead low. People are yearning to measure the full distance of their potential on behalf of the causes that they care about deeply. But they have to be asked. Our generation does not want its epitaph to read, "We kept charity overhead low." We wanted to read that we changed the world, and that part of the way we did that was by changing the way we think about these things. So the next time you're looking at a charity, don't ask about the rate of their overhead. Ask about the scale of their dreams, their Apple, Google, Amazon scale dreams, how they measure their progress toward those dreams, and what resources they need to make them come true, regardless of what the overhead is. Who cares what the overhead is if these problems are actually getting solved? If we can have that kind of generosity, a generosity of thought, then the nonprofit sector can play a massive role in changing the world for all those citizens most desperately in need of it to change. Thank you.
Wow.
But I mean, is it ever going to change, you know, the way we think about how charities should operate?
Absolutely, it's going to change. We're going to make it change. We just need to get methodical about it. And the nonprofit sector has not been methodical about it. We don't have an anti-defamation league, despite the fact that we get defamed in the media all the time. The nonprofit sector has not taken responsibility for its full self-expression, in part because it thinks that it's wrong to be self-interested. Well, imagine if the gay community thought self-interest was a bad thing. If we cannot liberate ourselves from these restraints, we cannot possibly liberate people from poverty and disease and the other things.
So where do you start? How do you make it happen?
you know, the famous, iconic John Kennedy quote, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Well, I think people have been asking, and nobody's been giving them anything big to do. You know, we just underestimate people all the time. People want to make a difference, and they want to make a big difference, and they want to do something epic and heroic in this lifetime. Sometimes they don't even know it till you show it to them.
Dan Pallotta. He wrote a book about all this. It's called Charity Case. You can see all of Dan's talk at TED.com. Coming up, a friend he made on his way to give that talk.
So I get on the plane, and there's this woman sitting next to me, and she's making all these weird hand movements.
And she's wearing this, like, weird makeup.
Weird makeup. And then she pulls out a TED catalog, and I said, are you going to TED? And she goes, yeah, I'm speaking. And I said, oh, I am too. And she said, what's your name? And she starts flipping through the catalog. And
musician Amanda Palmer.
Dan and I are making plans to have him bring his kids over to my house for dinner.
That's great.
We've made best friends, and we loved each other's talks.
Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz. On the show today, giving it away. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Hey, everyone. It's Guy here. Just a quick shout out to another NPR podcast that we think you will really love. It's about games, puzzles, trivia of all sorts. It's called Ask Me Another. It's got brain teasers, comedy, music. It's hosted by my friend Ophira Eisenberg. You can find Ask Me Another in your iTunes store under podcasts. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. So maybe the best way to describe musician Amanda Palmer, let me just play it for you. This is what happens when you take punk music and you mash it together with cabaret. You get Amanda Palmer, or as she's formally known to her fans, Amanda Palmer.
My real middle name is McKinnon, which is my Scottish family name.
That's very different than the one you've adopted.
Yeah, my mom's none too pleased. Thank God my grandmother's dead. She hated it.
Now, long before she had millions of fans, long before she'd become a symbol of giving it all away, Amanda Palmer was a statue. Here's her TED Talk.
I was a self-employed living statue called the 8-Foot Bride, and I love telling people I did this for a job, because everybody always wants to know who are these freaks in real life. Hello. I painted myself white one day, stood on a box, put a hat or a can at my feet, and when someone came by and dropped in money, I handed them a flower and some intense eye contact. And if they didn't take the flower, I threw in a gesture of sadness and longing as they walked away. So I had the most profound encounters with people, especially lonely people who looked like they hadn't talked to anyone in weeks. And we would get this beautiful moment of prolonged eye contact being allowed in a city street, and we would sort of fall in love a little bit. And my eyes would say, thank you, I see you. And their eyes would say, nobody ever sees me. Thank you. And I would get harassed. Sometimes people would yell at me from their passing cars, get a job! And I'd be like, is this my job? But it hurt because it made me fear that I was somehow doing something unjob-like and unfair, shameful. I had no idea how perfect a real education I was getting for the music business on this box. When you're a street performer, your whole mentality is trained to give away your talent for free in exchange for, you know, hopeful support. and you spend your life with the hat out, having faith in strangers and watching it work. Watching it work is the important part. And I had so much experience year after year after year trusting passersby and having faith in people that I could make my living this way that I really just started to take it for granted.
And in Amanda's case, trust actually became a kind of a business model, not intentionally, but it just sort of worked out that way, even as her career in the music industry started to take off.
So I couch surf a lot. I also crowd surf a lot. I maintain couch surfing and crowd surfing are basically the same thing. You're falling into the audience and you're trusting each other. I once tweeted, where in Melbourne can I buy a neti pot? And a nurse from a hospital drove one right at that moment to the cafe I was in, and I bought her a smoothie, and we sat there talking about nursing and death. And I love this kind of random closeness, which is lucky, because I do a lot of couch surfing. In mansions where everyone on my crew gets their own room, but there's no wireless, and in punk squats, everyone on the floor in one room with no toilets, but with wireless, clearly making it the better option. My crew once pulled our van up to a really poor Miami neighborhood, and we found out that our couch surfing host for the night was an 18-year-old girl still living at home, and her family were all undocumented immigrants from Honduras. And that night, her whole family took the couches, and she slept together with her mom so that we could take their beds. And I lay there thinking, these people have so little. Is this fair? And in the morning, her mom taught us how to try to make tortillas and wanted to give me a Bible. And she took me aside and she said to me in her broken English, your music has helped my daughter so much. Thank you for staying here. We're all so grateful. And I thought, this is fair. I once asked an opening band of mine if they wanted to go out into the crowd and pass the hat to get themselves some extra money, something that I did a lot. And as usual, the band was psyched, but there was this one guy in the band who told me he just couldn't bring himself to go out there. It felt too much like begging to stand there with the hat. And I recognized his fear of, is this fair? And get a job. And meanwhile, my band is becoming bigger and bigger. We sign with a major label. And there's all this hype leading up to our next record. And it comes out and it sells about 25,000 copies in the first few weeks. And the label considers this a failure. And I was like, 25,000, isn't that a lot? They were like, no, the sales are going down. It's a failure. And they walk off. Right at the same time, I'm signing and hugging after a gig. And a guy comes up to me and hands me a $10 bill. And he says, I'm sorry, I burned your CD from a friend. But I read your blog. I know you hate your label. I just want you to have this money. And this starts happening all the time. I become the hat after my own gigs, but I have to physically stand there and take the help from people. And unlike the guy in the opening band, I've actually had a lot of practice standing there. And this is the moment I decide I'm just gonna give away my music for free.
You decided to just give it away.
Well, the decision was kind of made for me because once music was burnable and emailable, it seemed to me music simply was free. And I could charge for it, but, you know, it was sort of like charging for rain falling from the sky. I mean, it just seemed like this inevitable shift that had happened in culture where digital music was freely shareable between any two people who had a phone or a computer. So those who appreciate it and are into it will be moved to contribute to it.
And I'm going to encourage torrenting, downloading, sharing, but I'm going to ask for help because I saw it work on the street. So I fought my way off my label, and for my next project with my new band, the Grand Theft Orchestra, I turned to crowdfunding. And I fell into those thousands of connections that I'd made, and I asked my crowd to catch me. And the goal was $100,000. My fans backed me at nearly $1.2 million, which was the biggest music crowdfunding project to date. And you can see how many people it is. It's about 25,000 people. And the media asked, Amanda, the music business is tanking and you encourage piracy. How did you make all these people pay for music? And the real answer is, I didn't make them. I asked them.
Did it work right away?
Yeah, absolutely. And I also, I didn't do it as an anonymous entity. I went out as Amanda Palmer, the human being, and asked my fans, the audience, the human beings, hey, this is how I want to do it. This is how we're all doing it. Clearly, can I count on you guys to help me so that I can pay my rent? And their answer was, of course, we'll help you as much as we can. And at their varying levels, I mean, a lot of fans, you know, wrote back to me or commented on blogs or tweeted very sheepishly, well, I'm going to take your music for free because I'm broke, but can I pay you back later? And I would write back enthusiastically, yeah, that's the point. I'd rather you have my music than you didn't, so go ahead and take it. Someone else will cover you, or you'll cover me down the line, or, you know, it'll sort of all karmically, cosmically work out. And through the very act of asking people, I'd connected with them. And when you connect with them, people want to help you. It's kind of counterintuitive for a lot of artists. They don't want to ask for things, but it's not easy. It's not easy to ask. And a lot of artists have a problem with this. Asking makes you vulnerable. And I got a lot of criticism online after my Kickstarter went big for continuing my crazy crowdsourcing practices, specifically for asking musicians who are fans if they wanted to join us on stage for a few songs in exchange for love and tickets and beer, and people saying you're not allowed anymore to ask for that kind of help really reminded me of the people in their cars yelling, get a job, because they weren't with us on the sidewalk and they couldn't see the exchange that was happening between me and my crowd, an exchange that was very fair to us but alien to them.
At times, do you second guess it?
You know, not much. And the joy of asking my fans for things like places to sleep and food and rides and all of it is that I see the joy they take in helping me and helping each other. You know, it's sort of like this happens on tour. Six people will come to a show and bring us cookies. And I'm sitting there with my crew who are like trying to be really healthy and one of them is vegan. And we're just like surrounded by this bounty of food that we can't possibly eat. And I actually find this wonderful, weird karmic circle where we get to the next city and we share all the leftover food in the signing line the next night. And I know that for the girl who spent the afternoon of the show making a bunch of brownies and then being able to give them to me and my band, that made her feel wonderful.
And you too.
And me too. And then the people on the other end that we got to share the brownies with the next night. I mean, you could put a full stop on it, or you could just kind of do what we do, which is we let it all fly. And we know that the whole thing's going to be chaotic, but life is never boring and there's a lot of love, even if it's a little unorganized.
It sounds like the giving and the asking stuff is just a small part of what's really about just connection, just connecting.
Yeah, well, that's what it always comes down to, isn't it? And that's what music and going to shows and supporting art, I think, really fundamentally is for people. People crave connection with art, with artists, with each other. I mean, these things are as old as the hills. If you remember that fundamentally, part of why we love art is that it connects us in an inexplicable way, all these things sort of start to come into focus and make more sense, I think.
But asking can be terrifying. I mean, it can be really scary.
For sure.
And a lot of us don't feel comfortable doing it for that reason.
Yeah, well, asking goes hand in hand with the possibility of being rejected. You know, the act of asking for something when someone might say no can be so terrifying and so paralyzing to some that they figure it's safer not to ask. We're all so geared to be independent and self-reliant and, you know, you should be able to figure this out yourself. You should be able to do it yourself. And in the culture we live in, I wonder if the fact that this talk has resonated so hard with people actually just says something really profound about who we've become and how we've turned away from asking each other for help because there's so much fear.
But fear because we think we're on the hook, like we'll owe someone something?
Yeah. These are like the core issues of what the talk hit on with people. There's a really fantastic book by Lewis Hyde called The Gift, and he tells a wonderful anecdote in the beginning of the book about how in Native American culture, gifts were sort of circulated. So if you went over to another chief's house, you'd bring a pipe, you'd smoke it, and you'd leave it there. And then the next time he went over to someone's place, he would bring the pipe along, and it would sort of be the circulating gift. And the term Indian giver comes from the cultural clashing phenomenon of a pilgrim going over to, you know, to an Indian chief's joint and smoking this beautiful pipe, and the Indian chief gives him the pipe, and the pilgrim thinks he's scored this beautiful pipe that he can keep. And then a few months later, another Indian chief comes over and sees the pipe and sort of expectantly assumes that this pipe is going to come back to him. And thus the term Indian giver, someone who wants their gift back. But Lewis Hyde says very cleverly that maybe the term for this should actually be white man keeper. You know, it really is how we think of giving and receiving and asking and sharing.
The things I've done, the Kickstarter, the street, I don't see these things as risk. I see them as trust. Now, the online tools to make the exchange as easy and as instinctive as the street, they're getting there. Celebrity is about a lot of people loving you from a distance. But the internet and the content that we're freely able to share on it are taking us back. It's about a few people loving you up close and about those people being enough. But the perfect tools aren't going to help us if we can't face each other and give and receive fearlessly, but more important, to ask without shame. My music career has been spent trying to encounter people on the internet the way I could on the box. So blogging and tweeting, not just about my tour dates and my new video, but about our work and our art and our fears and our hangovers, our mistakes, and we see each other. And I think when we really see each other, we want to help each other. I think people have been obsessed with the wrong question, which is how do we make people pay for music? What if we started asking, how do we let people pay for music? Thank you.
Musician Amanda Palmer. Her TED Talk has been viewed by more than 2 million people. Check out her full talk at TED.com and check out our interview with Amanda about the process of writing her TED Talk. You can hear that at TED.npr.org or through our podcast page on iTunes.
It doesn't matter if you want it back. You've given it away. You've given it away. It doesn't matter if you want it back. You've given it away.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show this week. If you missed any of it, or if you want to hear more, you want to find out more about who was on it,
You can visit ted.npr.org. You can also find many more TED Talks at ted.com. You can download the show through iTunes or through the NPR smartphone app. Our program was produced by Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Neva Grant, and Sanaz Meshkinpour, with help from Portia Robertson-Migas and Eric Newsom. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Hey, if you are still listening to this right now after the credits, you must be a complete NPR junkie, like a total maniac. So let me give you another suggestion to feed your fix. It's a show called Ask Me Another. It's a trivia game with puzzles and music in front of a live audience. It's hosted by my friend Ophira Eisenberg. It is absolutely hilarious. You will love it. So check out Ask Me Another in iTunes, and you'll find it under podcasts.